Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.7, Siege of Missolonghi, Greek Revolution, Part 5. Last time, we left off as Mavrocordatos and his islander allies, the Kondoriotis brothers, were solidifying their power amongst the Greeks. Kolokotronis, for his part, was now locked away alongside his fellow Peloponnesian leaders in a prison within Mavrocordatos' home territory of western mainland Greece. What this meant was that Mavrocordatos and the Kondoriotis brothers were now on top, coming out of the civil wars that had been fought off and on from 1823 to 1825. However, this state of affairs would only last a few months, as everything would suddenly change in May 1825, once the Egyptians lent the power of their mighty army to the side of the Sultan. Sultan Mahmud II, who has kind of gotten sidelined and who I have mostly been referring to as just the Sultan, as we have had a lot of other things to talk about, had had quite a lot on his plate as of late. And because there were so many other things for him to worry about, the rebellious Greeks had been kind of allowed to just fight amongst themselves for a couple of years. The first of these bigger things on the Sultan's plate was Ali Pasha, the powerful governor in western Greece who had rebelled against the Sultan way back in 1820, and who, as we noted, had given the Greek rebels the breathing room they needed to initially take the Peloponnese. Well, fast forward to 1822, and Sultan Mahmud had finally been able to subdue the forces of Ali Pasha. Then, amidst the surrender negotiations, a small firefight broke out, and one of the Sultan's agents managed to kill Ali, finally putting an end to the decades-long rule of this rebellious Albanian leader. However, even after Ali was dead and gone, the Sultan still had many other things to worry about other than the Greeks, as he was simultaneously losing a war to the Persians over some ongoing border disputes. And yes, as you've probably gathered by now, the Ottomans at this point were always fighting at least like three wars at a time, and this war with the Persians did not go too well for the Ottomans, though they did manage to get out of it without much territorial loss when the war finally came to a close in the summer of 1823. With Ali Pasha now out of the picture, and as the war with the Persians was in the rearview mirror, Sultan Mahmud now finally had the breathing room he needed to put more of his attention towards the Greeks, who had for years now just been kind of ruling themselves and fighting amongst each other just as much as they were fighting off the Ottomans. Though the inability of the Sultan to subdue the Greeks was a source of embarrassment for the Sultan, and he needed to once and for all do away with these pesky revolutionaries. So in the summer of 1825, Sultan Mahmud made his first good decision in fighting the Greeks when he finally realized that his army just wasn't going to get the job done, and so he needed to bring in the help of the Egyptians. Okay, so two episodes from now, we are going to dedicate an entire episode to Egypt and their great modernizer, Muhammad Ali. So for now, I am going to skip over quite a bit and just try to get you up to speed on the basics. And yes, before you ask, we will have one more episode after this one dedicated to the Greek Revolution. I thought I could do it in five, but this episode just kept getting longer and longer, and I didn't want to cut out any of the good stuff because of some arbitrary boundary I set for myself a while back. So this episode and next episode will bring us to the end of the Greek Revolution. Then after that, we will look more closely at events in Egypt surrounding Muhammad Ali. And as we'll see, the figure of Muhammad Ali offers a nice segue out of the Greek Revolution as we reimmerse ourselves in the broader politics of the now truly crumbling Ottoman Empire. But for now, Muhammad Ali in brief. Muhammad Ali really began his career when he was sent to Egypt in 1801 from his home in Kavala, actually a city in modern-day Greece, though Muhammad Ali was not ethnically Greek, but was a Muslim of either Kurdish or Turkic descent. Ali was sent to Alexandria as part of an expedition to reoccupy Egypt after the French had been driven out. You may recall that Napoleon had invaded Egypt in 1798. Due to this brief French occupation, there was now a power vacuum left in Egypt that Muhammad Ali would masterfully fill through the tried-and-true combination of Ottoman pashas. He ruthlessly repressed his enemies while he at the same time built a loyal cohort of officials directly beholden to him personally. To keep it short, Muhammad Ali basically completely wiped out the elite ruling class of Egypt, the Mamluks, who were warrior slaves who had ruled Egypt for like over 500 years. Simultaneously, Ali brought in a new class of officials from his hometown in Kavala over to Egypt, whose only loyalty in the region was to Muhammad Ali personally. One of the most important aspects of Muhammad Ali's incredible rise was his ability to create a modernized military within Egypt. In so doing, Muhammad Ali successfully did what the sultans had largely been unable to do: bring in European advisors to help build a European-style modern standing army. Ali became a master at charming Europeans, winning them over with Oriental showmanship and gleaning knowledge from them to help him grow his power. Several of these Europeans, many of whom were Napoleonic War veterans, would remain in Egypt and became some of his most trusted and loyal agents. This project of military modernization was hugely successful, and early on, Muhammad Ali fought many campaigns on behalf of the Sultan. Basically, Ali went around and reconquered provinces who had rebelled against Ottoman authority, and as we have seen, these rebellions were becoming a huge problem for the Ottomans at the time. So Muhammad Ali became more and more indispensable for the Sublime Porte. And while he would conquer these domains in the name of the Ottoman Empire, Muhammad Ali was quickly becoming potentially more powerful even than the Sultan himself. Ali would eventually hold within his personal domain a territory greater than that of the entire rest of the Ottoman Empire. But that is for later. Around the time of the Greek Revolution, Muhammad Ali had reconquered the Arabian Peninsula that had broken away, including the holy cities of Mecca and Medina in the Hejaz, and then he was currently in the process of conquering the Sudan. Through these campaigns, Muhammad Ali had proven himself to be a winning horse, and was at this point still professing his loyalty to the Sultan, though this will change. So Sultan Mahmud decided that he had no choice but to turn to Muhammad Ali and the Egyptians to help him suppress the Greek rebels. And in the summer of 1824, Muhammad Ali answered the Sultan's call and sent his son Ibrahim to lead an army to once and for all suppress the Greek revolt in the Peloponnese. After a couple of hiccups along the way, Ibrahim Pasha would finally land in the Peloponnese in early 1825, just as our old friends Mavrocordatos and the Kondoriotis brothers were solidifying their position over the Peloponnesian warlords. You may remember from last time that Mavrocordatos and his islander allies had used their access to English loans to come out on top after the second outbreak of hostilities between Greek rebel leaders. Mavrocordatos and the islanders had thereafter captured Kolokotrones and other Peloponnesian clefts and notables and imprisoned them in Mavrocordatos' stomping ground in western mainland Greece. So, the Greeks were in a divided and fractious state, to say the least, when Muhammad Ali's son pulled up to the Peloponnese. During his journey from Alexandria to the Greek Isles, Ibrahim Pasha had been harassed by Greek naval forces, most notably by the now famous fire ships, in which Greek sailors would fill ships with explosive materials and light them on fire, thereafter sailing them at enemy flotillas. Greek sailors and merchants became very good at this technique, and it was used quite effectively against Ibrahim and the Egyptians as they made their way across the Mediterranean in the fall of 1824. Because of this, many of the Greek leaders thought that they had successfully held off Ibrahim for the time being, as winter was beginning to arrive, and many of the Egyptian supplies had been depleted. The Greeks would quickly learn, however, that Ibrahim Pasha was not messing around. Conventions of warfare at this time typically held that campaigns would end at the onset of winter. But Ibrahim would flaunt all of these unwritten rules and would instead land his forces in the Peloponnese smack dab in the middle of winter in February of 1825. Having brought over some 20,000 troops, Ibrahim would set up camp in the port of Methone, which was one of those Peloponnesian fortresses that had remained in Ottoman hands during the years-long stalemate. The Egyptians were able to land somewhat easily in the Peloponnese, largely because the provisional Greek government, now being led by the Kondoriotis brothers, had been pretty flippant about the threat that Ibrahim Pasha posed and were more concerned with defeating their Greek rivals in the civil war. In fact, when the Kondoriotis government learned about the impending Egyptian invasion, they decided to fortify islands such as Idra and to leave the Peloponnesian ports mostly undefended. A decision that I am sure had nothing to do with the fact that the Kondoriotis brothers hailed from the now very well defended island of Idra, and that the home territory of their rivals in the Peloponnese was basically left undefended. On the Peloponnesian Peninsula itself, the situation was not great for the Greeks. The main forces who were positioned to fight off Ibrahim Pasha were not native Peloponnesians, but were in fact Western Greeks from the mainland, who were essentially occupying the territory after the Civil War. The local Peloponnesians pretty much hated these occupying troops with a passion and offered them no help at all. And then the local armed bands from the Peloponnese, of which there were still many, refused to fight until their leaders, Kolokotrones, principal among them, were released from their imprisonment in western Greece. Because of the sorry state of Greek forces, the Egyptians had little trouble against their opponents early on, and quickly advanced into Greek territory. The first major loss for the Greeks was the fortress of Navarino, which had been in Greek hands since the uprising began way back in 1821. Remember the name Navarino. The loss of Navarino began to demonstrate to the Greeks that they were not facing off against another incompetent expedition led by the Sultan, but they were instead taking on a well-organized modern army. With momentum fully on his side, Ibrahim steadily pushed further and further into the Peloponnese, only really being challenged by the occasional guerrilla hit-and-run attack. The Kondoriotis government, along with Mavrocordatos, now fully understood that trying to hold off the Egyptians with their unpopular occupying forces from western Greece was simply not going to cut it, so the government was forced to release the Peloponnesian notables and clefts from their imprisonment. And with this release, Kolokotrones made a triumphant return to Tripolitsa, and many of the armed bands flocked to the old cleft to help him fight off the Egyptian wave now barreling towards them. However, even with a newly formed united front, the Greeks still had trouble against Ibrahim because Kolokotrones and the other warlords were fighting like it was still 1821. Ibrahim had a modernized army with which he could launch well-planned campaigns, while the Greek forces were made up of dozens of different armed bands who were, yes, much more loyal to Kolokotrones than they were to Mavrocordatos and the islanders, but who nonetheless could still not really be counted on. This made it nearly impossible to plan out any sort of coordinated counterattack, as the number of fighters at Kolokotrones' disposal would massively fluctuate, as literally thousands of troops at a time might just return home or simply decide they didn't feel like fighting at that specific time and place. Because of this, the clefts and warlords fought the Egyptians using their old guerrilla warfare techniques of surprise attacks, hit and runs, and night raids. In order to combat this, Ibrahim Pasha launched a ruthless anti-guerrilla campaign using scorched earth tactics that devastated the Peloponnesian countryside and made the terrified Greek peasants less and less willing to help the rebel fighters. And terror was indeed one of Ibrahim's primary strategies, as he sought to destroy the revolution's will to fight. As part of this campaign of terror, Ibrahim would specifically target civilian populations by capturing and enslaving women and children and sending them off to distant parts of the Ottoman Empire under his father Muhammad Ali's dominion. And as these stories of Greek enslavement and other atrocities being committed by Ibrahim's army spread throughout the Peloponnese, fear began to ripple through the Greek peasantry. And many Greek civilians had simply had enough at this point, and had decided, not without good reason, that all of these armed men, Egyptian, Turkish, even Greek, were not to be trusted. Had not the Greek leaders themselves just spent the last 2 years fighting each other more than they fought the Ottomans? And while they fought each other, the hungry soldiers were always taking food and supplies from the peasants, usually at gunpoint. This is not to say that local Greek leaders did not protect the peasantry against Ottoman attack. They definitely did, and the moral scruples of these different leaders could vary wildly. Many were noble and heroic, many were, well, not. But due to the fact that Greek armies had to supply themselves largely at the expense of the peasantry, there was a growing distrust between the civilian and armed populations of the Peloponnese. This dynamic was most clearly expressed in the movement that grew around an eccentric Greek Orthodox priest who became known as Papoulakis, or simply the Little Father, or Little Priest. Papoulakis traveled throughout the northwest Peloponnese, accompanied by a nun whose name, unfortunately, seems to have been lost to history. But Papoulakis and the nun became known for being able to see into the future and for performing miracles. And along with this reputation for mystical abilities, Papoulakis also preached a message of peace and repentance that resonated with the deeply religious Greek peasants who had grown extremely weary of years of endless violence. Papoulakis and the nun quickly gained a large following, reaching the height of their popularity in the summer of 1825, while Ibrahim Pasha was executing his campaign of terror against the Greeks. What made the message of Papoulakis novel was the fact that he was essentially a pacifist, and he preached to ever-growing crowds the message that Greeks who had stolen, enslaved, or killed Muslims, even during times of war, were guilty of sinning against God. Papoulakis told his followers to lay down their weapons and that he would lead them against Ibrahim Pasha completely unarmed, trusting in the power of God to defend them against their sinful enemies. Due to his growing popularity, Papoulakis came to the attention of Greek revolutionary leaders who became extremely wary of this weird dude who was going around and telling everyone to get rid of their weapons. Papoulakis, for his part, made as a central part of his message the idea that Greek leaders were causing the Greek people to stray away from God through their violence and plundering. There is even one story of a Greek chieftain who, after hearing the teachings of Papoulakis, laid down his weapons and decided to become a monk. Kolokotrones and the other Greek warlords became very worried about the effect that Papoulakis and the nun were having on the will of the Greek people to continue fighting the Ottomans. Many Greek chieftains went to see Papoulakis to try to win him over in some way. However, they were more often than not forced to just kind of sit around and listen to his sermons as large crowds followed the priest around, and these crowds could easily turn into a mob should one of these chieftains, you know, talk ill of their spiritual leader. So, under the protection of their followers, Papoulakis and the nun continued to preach to large crowds of peasants throughout Ibrahim Pasha's campaign to retake the Peloponnese. While Ibrahim Pasha was methodically reconquering the Peloponnese, Sultan Mahmud made his second uncharacteristically good decision in facing the Greek revolutionaries when he appointed Kotahil Pasha to lead a campaign to retake western mainland Greece, a campaign that would be simultaneous with Ibrahim Pasha's southern campaign to retake the Peloponnese. Kotahil Pasha. And yes, I know it is pretty hard to keep track of all these darn pashas, but just wait until we get to World War I, where like every single leader is a pasha. But just remember, these dudes are not related. I, in fact, made that mistake when I was first learning about the Ottoman Empire, and I was like, how is everyone's last name Pasha? But Pasha is basically just what Westerners might understand as like a lord, though it was often used for military leaders specifically. So this is just like Lord Ibrahim or like General Kotahil. That's all to say, I know it's confusing, but now back to the narrative. Like Muhammad Ali, Kotahil Pasha's story is especially interesting in that it shows how diverse, cosmopolitan, and really meritocratic the leadership of the Ottoman Empire was by this point in its history. Born in modern-day Georgia as the son of a Christian Orthodox priest, Kutahil was captured as a young boy and brought into the household of a powerful Ottoman official who eventually became the head of the Imperial Navy. Like many Christians from the periphery who found themselves thrust against their will into an unfamiliar Ottoman imperial world, Kutahil decided to make the best of his situation, converting to Islam and then working tirelessly for his Ottoman master. Through this tireless work ethic, Kutahil would earn his title as Pasha and even eventually become the Grand Vizier in 1829. But for now, Kutahil's task was to force the rebels of Western Greece to resubmit to Ottoman rule. And this meant taking Missolonghi, the coastal town of Western Greece that had been in the hands of the Greeks stretching all the way back to the early days of 1821 when Mavrocordatos was building his power base in that area and convincing the local chieftains to get on board with his constitutional aspirations. As a major stronghold for the Greek provisional government, Missolonghi had long been sought after by the Ottomans and had already at this point miraculously survived no less than two sieges. Then, a year earlier, Lord Byron had famously died in the town just after the second siege had ended. As Kutahil Pasha made his way towards the town with thousands of troops, Greek civilians began fleeing the invading army, flooding into the town of Missolonghi for protection. Then, the Ottoman army started digging into the area surrounding the town, beginning the siege that would last for nearly a year. At first, it seemed that the third siege of Missolonghi would go the way of the first two sieges as the town settled in for what now, I am sure, was beginning to feel just kind of like the hardships of everyday life. You know, well, here comes another siege. And for the first 6 months of the siege, the Greeks were able to maintain communication with the outside, and supplies were still getting through the Ottoman lines. The inability of the Ottomans to completely cut off the town was what had prevented them from taking Missolonghi in the past, so it did seem like the Greeks of Missolonghi might just make it through this siege as well. But what made this third siege different was the same thing that made this entire phase of the war different: Ibrahim Pasha and his Egyptian army. Kutahil had sent word to Ibrahim to ask his fellow Pasha for help in besieging the town, and the Egyptians had decided to answer the call. So in December of 1825, after nearly 7 months of being besieged, the townspeople of Missolonghi began to see Ibrahim's army of Arab soldiers lining up outside the walls of their town. Now facing two armies, with Ibrahim's contingent bringing the Ottoman forces up to nearly 30,000 troops, the siege really began to tighten, and eventually the town would be completely cut off in ways that they hadn't been during the earlier two sieges. This meant that starvation, malnutrition, and disease really began to set in over the winter and spring of 1826. And as so often happens during a siege, there were stories of people eating grass, weeds, and other random plants, as well as cats, dogs, and rats, and some people even resorted to cannibalism. Though even while under these horrific conditions, the town remained remarkably orderly without much in the way of theft or looting. In many ways, the siege seems to have brought the inhabitants of the town closer together, with many following the lead of the town bishop, who organized efforts to fortify the town walls and to bring supplies to the soldiers defending them. The bishop would continue to give services to the town throughout the siege, and he even oversaw the marriage of two young lovebirds from some of the town's most illustrious families. The solidarity achieved through mutual hardship amongst the Greeks in Missolonghi lay in stark contrast, however, to the bitterly entrenched divisions that still remained amongst the revolutionary leaders on the outside. And this division on the outside would leave the town pretty much on their own. A delegation from Missolonghi, who had been able to escape through the lines, had been sent to the Greek provisional government under the Kondriotis brothers and Mavrocordatos in search of relief for their besieged town. Though at this point, the Kondriotis government was a complete mess, to say the least. having basically spent all of their money fighting the Peloponnesians in the Civil War, the provisional government was unable to provide really anything financially, and they only gave over a small amount basically once the delegation from Missolonghi forced them to give over something. Like, come on guys, give us something. Now, the government did sort of have an army cobbled together at this point. However, they had no money and could not afford to pay their troops. So, even if they had wanted to send a contingent to go aid Missolonghi, which it was not clear that they wanted to do that, they were pretty much unable to get the notoriously unruly chieftains and sailors to go risk their lives for, like, no pay. Instead, many of these chieftains and sailors were at this point going back to their old ways of highway robbery and piracy just in order to survive. And you can't really blame them, because highway robbery and piracy was like tens of times more lucrative than fighting for a government that was completely broke and that only had like the thinnest veneer of sovereign authority at this point. So this meant that Missolonghi was pretty much alone in their struggle. And as things began to get more and more desperate, their plans also began to get more and more desperate. And after many days of heated discussion, the leaders of the town decided to try a sortie, which in this case essentially meant that a large group of armed townspeople were going to launch a surprise attack against the Ottoman line with the goal of breaking out and escaping into the hills. The reason that the inhabitants landed on this plan was that they suspected that if they surrendered, they would either be massacred or enslaved. The Ottoman leaders, Ibrahim and Kutahil, had offered terms to the town that ensured their relative safety in exchange for submitting. However, the Greeks in Missolonghi had heard the stories of mass enslavement at the hands of Ibrahim's Egyptian army. And they remembered all too well that when the Greeks themselves had sacked Tripolitsa 5 years earlier, a siege with striking similarities but kind of in reverse, the Muslim inhabitants in the town had been victims of a brutal massacre themselves. So the Greeks of Missolonghi had every reason to believe that if they surrendered, they would either be killed or enslaved. Convinced of this, the inhabitants decided instead to go down fighting. So those fit for battle were armed and began to organize the mass breakout. Those unable to fight resolved to barricade themselves within the few buildings that remained in the town, and many of these people locked themselves in with explosives so that they could blow themselves up when the enemy came, preferring death over enslavement at the hands of the Ottomans. The town bishop was the principal leader amongst these martyrs who resolved to remain behind. And he and many followers would, after the sortie had been launched, barricade themselves in an old mill for several days before lighting explosives and blowing themselves up. The lucky ones from Missolonghi were in many ways those taking part in the breakout. Even though much planning had gone into the sortie, in the end, the escape was quite chaotic due to the fact that, at first, the inhabitants still expected to receive assistance in their plan from the forces of the provisional government, who were meant to provide cover fire for them. But as we have just seen, that was not going to happen. Second, the Ottomans were fully aware of the plan to escape by the time the sortie actually happened. Because of this, when the signal for the sortie went off, only half of the fighters were actually ready to engage, while the other half were still in the town saying their goodbyes to their loved ones. When those still back in the town heard sounds of fighting, they thought that it was actually an Ottoman attack, so they retreated into the town instead of joining in the escape. This meant that one half of the sortie was running at the Ottoman line, while the other half was running back into the town. Nevertheless, those attacking the Ottoman line were fighters who had during the past several years become quite adept at night attacks, especially within the terrain surrounding their town, which they knew very well. With this local expertise, and due to the fact that these fighters knew they were either going to die, be enslaved, or escape, they were filled with a kind of berserker fighting spirit, and many of the Greeks actually broke through the Ottoman lines and escaped up into the hills. Like we said earlier, though, that some 2,000 men and women who were part of the breakout were the lucky ones, because Once the town was taken by the combined forces of Ibrahim and Kutahil, the majority of the town either died at the hands of the Ottomans, were enslaved and sent off to faraway lands, or sacrificed themselves because they refused to face this terrible fate. But as it has been with so many things in the Greek Revolution, the real impact of the Siege of Missolonghi did not center around events in Greece itself, but rather in the cafes, salons, concert halls, and increasingly, courts and halls of government in Europe. And so, as we will see next time, the sacrifice of the townspeople of Missolonghi, who had given their lives for the dream of Greek independence, would not be in vain, as stories of their heroic deeds, as well as of the brutal atrocities of Ibrahim Pasha's invading army, began to filter back into Great Britain, France, and Russia. And indeed, it will be these three great powers who will hold the keys to Greece's independence, because they were beginning to ignore the always hesitating and plotting Metternich, meaning that they would, after standing on the sideline for nearly 6 years, finally intervene and bring the Greek War of Independence to an abrupt and sudden close.